May 14, 2007, and open a hearing on Senate Bill 5513, the Department of Fish and Wildlife Budget Bill. Please proceed at your leisure. Hopefully some more members of the committee will show up.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. I think we're ready to start with the Wildlife Division this morning. I have Ron Hamblin here, our Wildlife Division Administrator. Ron?
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. This morning, what I thought I would do is not go into a lot of detail on each one of the individual programs within the division, keep it at a fairly high level, and then focus in on the key issues, the POPs, and then there were several questions that came out of the committee last week that I'd like to address. Within the governor's recommended budget, the department would have a little over $60 million in funding. That's found on page 120 of your budget book from the department. And those funds are divided between other fund, which are primarily licensed dollars, federal fund, and general fund. Within the Wildlife Division, we have three major sub-programs, the Game Program, the Habitat Program, and the Diversity Program. Each of those are fairly discrete units, but they do work cooperatively together, and a lot of the projects that they work on are intertwined. Within the Game Program, the limitation request for the next biennium would be a little over $25 million. The bulk of that funding would come from other fund, followed with federal fund and general fund. And the bulk of the other fund within the Game Program is, in fact, licensed dollars. There is a significant portion, however, that are dedicated and obligated dollars that are tied to special subaccounts like waterfowl, upland birds, bighorn sheep, and things like that. And we can only spend those funds on those specific programs. Within the Game Program, we've identified three different key issues. One of those came up the other day relative to number of hunters, and I'll get into that in just a second. But as mentioned by our director, we are seeing a decline in the number of hunters in the state from historic numbers back in the 70s. Currently, we're around 256,000 resident hunters, and obviously when you're primarily driven by license and tag revenues and sales, that can have a major impact on your programs. Concern over recruitment and a lack of participation of hunters led the department a year ago to form a special work group that would look at hunter recruitment and retention. And that work group concluded last spring, and out of that came five different recommendations to the department. One was a marketing plan. The second was to assess current regulations and structure. The third was to survey lapsed hunters. And the fourth was to offer a mentored youth program. And finally, to form a standing committee that would help us with the different issues relative to hunter recruitment and retention. And this is a combination, Chair Devlin, of what's found in the general section of the Wildlife Division on page 119 are the key issues, and then within the Wildlife Game Program. The actions that we took as a result of the recommendations from that committee were pretty diverse. We have looked at primarily focusing on how to recruit and retain additional youth. We've done some things to address that. We've added two days to the end of the blacktail deer season that are for youth only. We originally were looking at introducing legislation ourselves relative to lowering the age that you could hunt big game, and decided not to do that and have one of the conservation or hunting organizations do that. There's a mentored youth hunting bill that is currently moving through the legislature that would accomplish that goal. We've established special youth turkey seasons that would be for the kids only, parents going along to help them with that. And we've also revised or are in the process of revising our current rules and regulations that in the past, if a youth had a tag for a youth season, and there also happened to be an adult season going on at the same time, the adult, if they had the tag, could not hunt at the same time as the youth. and we found that that was a barrier to participation, and we're revising the rules that would allow the two to hunt at the same time, even though they're hunting different species potentially and are using different tags. We've been going through a review through our I&E section of the Hunter Education Program. We've requested a marketing position within our budget, and the standing committee that they recommended, we've agreed to that. We haven't pulled them together for a while yet, but we will be using them in the future to look at different ideas and questions for us. The second key issue for the department, and as it relates to budget, has to do with cougars. The commission adopted a cougar management plan a year ago, and it has been quite controversial. The plan is designed to deal with conflict. The plan is designed to help the department control populations in certain areas where it's appropriate, and it is designed to make sure that we maintain a long-term population, healthy population of cougars in the state. And the department went through a fairly lengthy process to develop this plan. There was a lot of public comment received by the commission and the department before the commission finally approved it. How it affects from a budget standpoint is that within the plan there's five major objectives, and if the two key objectives of maintaining the population of greater than 3,000 animals, and if we meet that, and if we also meet the objective where non-hunting mortality or cats that are killed as a result of damage complaints or human safety complaints are above a certain level, then and only then the department can, in certain areas, implement what we call administrative removal in a targeted area. And that's where it gets into the budget, and it relates to a question that was asked by Representative Clem last week relative to savings on our budget if the agent bill were to pass. And the reason it gets into the budget for us is, as a result of Attorney General opinions, even though Measure 18 language says that the department can appoint agents, we have no statutory authority to appoint agents. Consequently, for those cases where the department would wish to use dogs to solve problems, use dogs relative to our research projects, we have to hire people as employees to do that work. And the agent bill, as I understand it and as written, would allow us to use volunteer agents who would in effect be free to do that work for us. The question came up last week then of, if you're paying somebody today to do this work and in the future you're using a volunteer agent, what would you do with those savings, or would there be savings generated? And the question's probably, or the answer's probably one of those typical bureaucratic type answers. Yes, there would be savings, but they'd only be kind of savings. And the reason I say that is that we reprioritized our current game damage program to pay for the actions that we're taking under the Cougar program today. So any savings that would be generated through the use of the agents in the future, those funds then would be directed back into the damage program and allow us to do some of our traditional work relative to fencing, hazing, and things like that associated with other big game damage and waterfowl damage. So that's why it's kind of a complicated answer on whether there would actually be savings or not relative to the use of agents. Just as an update for the committee, so far this year in implementation of the Cougar Plan, we have spent right at $110,000, and we have killed 26 cats on the three target areas, one of which is in Heppner, the other is, or just outside of Heppner, the other is in, the East Beulah, and the third is down in Jackson County, around the Medford area. Within those projects, we certainly have seen the best return for our dollar and the most success where we have used dogs to be able to track and catch cats. The third key issue that has budget implications for us is wolves. The department introduced a bill during this session that's legislative concept, House Bill 2295, that accomplish several different things. It would create or redesignate wolves as a game mammal, allow take without a permit, and create a compensation program. And we do have a POP in the game program relative to the compensation program. However, House Bill 2295 did not make it out of committee by the deadline, and my understanding is that the POP would not go anywhere as a result of that because the two were linked. We have spent a considerable amount of time as an agency investigating wolf sightings and reports. We've had over 40 in the last year. Those take a great deal of time to go out and investigate. We do not at this point in time have any hard conclusive evidence that we do have wolves in the state, even though we do highly suspect that they're here. It's just one of those that you see sign that you're pretty sure is it, but you don't have your hands on an animal yet. We're reluctant to accept pictures as proof that wolves are here. We've seen cases in the past of different wildlife that supposedly came from Oregon that when you track it down, they're internet pictures that people have scrambled around in and telling a different story. So we've been very reluctant to accept pictures that somebody else has taken as proof that wolves are here, and we're looking for that hard evidence ourselves. The budget implications for us from a wolf standpoint is we have a half-time position that's associated with the wolf program. It's funded as a combination within the diversity program of diversity checkoff dollars and federal funds through the state wildlife grant. And what's important about that is under the current contract, we're able to fund the federal portion with the 25-75 match. However, Congress this last fall, after we'd already submitted our budget request, did a revamp of the qualifications and make all future work under this contract will be required to come up with a 50-50 match for all the federal dollars. We do not have a 50-50 match currently cranked into our budget for this next biennium, so we'll be looking to do some shifts and some reprioritization within the diversity program during 2007-2009 to be able to meet our 50-50 match requirement. However, in 2009, we'll be looking to backfill that other 25% because it is coming out of other program and some other program needs in order to meet the short term. So just to set the stage, that 409, we will be looking not only for this but also for some other positions within the diversity program. We will be looking for additional match in order to address the federal requirements. Last week, Representative Burley had a question relative to hunter numbers and declines and impacts of lower populations of big game on hunter numbers. And you are exactly correct, Representative, that as we have seen declines in mule deer herds and in some cases elk herds, we have seen a decline in hunter participation, primarily because the department offers less tags, less hunting opportunity. We've seen during the late 80s and through the 90s, we've seen a significant increase in elk hunting opportunity, primarily in eastern Oregon, as we have taken very aggressive efforts to bring elk herds down to population management objective as required within our management plans. And as we've been successful in doing that, we've started to crank back on some of those elk tag numbers and the hunting opportunity. Irrespective of that, we have seen the declines in mule deer numbers due to a variety of factors and less opportunity. Mr.
We have a question. Representative Guerin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, I had a meeting with some of my hunters this past weekend. The number one reason they give me is the reduction in tax. They've just quit going because they can't get the tax to shoot anyway.
Chair Devlin, Representative Girard, that's correct. We recognize that, and it's pretty frustrating as we try. Obviously, we don't control habitat, and we don't control what happens on federal lands or on private lands. We can offer suggestions. We can try and apply pressure to various land management agencies or organizations and trying to make better big game habitat. But certainly, reduction in those numbers has resulted in a direct impact to hunting participation. And we don't see the deer hunting. It used to be a very big activity in this state. And since we've gone to the controlled hunts, as a result of declines in population, concerns over buck ratios, and being able to meet adequate numbers of bucks for breeding purposes, we've had to reduce opportunity. And that has resulted in a direct impact to hunter participation and our budget.
Just to kind of illustrate, back in the 60s, there was only Highway 66 between Klamath Falls and Ashland, and on the night before the opening of deer season, it was bumper to bumper for 20 miles in that area. And commercial stores downtown would have ladies' nights because guys were all gone, you know. And those days are gone, just completely gone.
Chair Devlin, Representative Girard, we've also, that actually extended into some portions of eastern Oregon into the 70s and the early 80s. And the opening weekend of deer season, opening weekend of elk season, opening weekend of pheasant season were a significant financial boost to these small rural local communities, as you saw an influx of people. And there's been a significant decline in hunter participation and in revenue for those local communities as a result of that.
Representative Pearl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, the question that I asked last week was, do you have any trend data for the number of tags applied for purchased, broken out by controlled hunt units and general units? Now, I think what you're telling me here with your answer today is that it's really not a function of the controlled hunt unit. The reason you have controlled hunts is because of the population levels. So it's really the population levels that are driving the tags. Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, that's correct. If populations are high, we will offer more tag, more hunting opportunity until we get to that point where hunters start expressing dissatisfaction over hunter crowding. That was also some of the early reasons why we went into controlled hunts and why we set up at hunter urging road closures in various portions of the state was hunter crowding. But since that time, we've seen significant population declines, and that is limited opportunity.
Well, now that doesn't follow up.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that necessarily follows, Ron, because if controlled hunts were put in place as a result of hunter dissatisfaction over seeing more hunters, that's a different issue than controlled hunts being put in place because there's fewer animals to hunt. That's two different causal factors.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, they're intertwined. During the late 80s, early 90s, we undertook a significant planning process, and there were several things that we needed to have addressed and that the public expected to be addressed. As an agency, we were seeing, we were having a very difficult time with the hunter pressure that we were having. We were seeing some declines in populations already in the late 80s, and we were not able to meet our buck ratio expectations for after the season. So we were unable in a lot of our eastern Oregon units to have enough bucks per 100 does to meet the breeding expectations that biologically we had set out there. At the same time, hunters were starting to express to us, as we saw increased roading in a lot of the eastern Oregon units and in western Oregon, expressing frustration over not being able to get away from a road. They jump a deer, somebody driving down the road would kill it, and asking for ways to create, in effect, quasi or semi-roadless areas, which is how the whole travel management areas and road closures came into being. As a result of all of that, we came up with a way to address the hunter crowding issue for those units that needed it through the road closures. But the controlled hunts, in a lot of ways, were designed specifically to get at the buck the buck ratio issues that we're developing, and we still were at population or above population management objectives. We actually didn't have management objectives prior to the plans in the early 90s, and we set them at that point in time, along with the public and with landowners. And since then, what we have seen is the populations have not, in a lot of areas, met those objectives. We've seen some declines, and we've had to reduce opportunity. For example, in the early 90s, in a good portion of south central and southeastern Oregon, we saw a fairly severe blue tongue outbreak and adenovirus outbreak that during the summer months, the disease really hammered deer. And that following winter, for those that were in Klamath Falls and Bend, remember that we had a lot of snow. And that was a double whammy on those deer populations. And since that time, we have not seen a lot of those deer herds recover in some of those areas to the levels they were prior to that point in time. As a result of that, we've lowered opportunity even further. And we've strived to update our models and our modeling or our inventory capabilities to further refine that, but it's based on buck ratios and management unit objectives.
You had also mentioned, Ron, that the department doesn't have control over the habitat, which I think, especially in eastern Oregon, for the most part, you're referring to the federal land management agencies. And I'm a little curious. I mean, obviously, they haven't been managing their lands much in the last 15 years, give or take. So how does the lack of management affect the big game populations? The lack of vegetative management on public lands affect big game habitat?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, it depends on what species that you might want to manage for. Certainly for deer, they're an early successional stage species, which means they like lots of disturbance. So the more timber harvest that you do, typically the more it favors the deer species. Elk tend to be a mid-successional range species that as deer habitat grows up and it's no longer very good for deer, it really becomes accessible and very usable for elk. So you get this long window of time for some different species where the habitats can be usable. I had a lot of frustration when I was on the Klamath with the forest where there were a lot of things that could have been done to benefit mule deer in South Central Oregon. As an agency, we highlight South Central as primarily deer units. And a lot of frustration that the forest was unable to go in and do some of the thinning projects, some of the bitter brush rejuvenation projects that would have been beneficial from a deer standpoint. So some of it is just being locked up within the federal system and trying to work things through that and the challenges that they face, obviously, to do that. On the other side of it is we have, through our Access and Habitat program, through other state programs, tried to work with private landowners to do a lot of things on their property that would be a benefit to big game species, and are continuing to try and expand those efforts throughout the state.
To generalize, there's two schools of thought. One is that you manage habitat for cover, thermal hiding cover, and the other is you manage it for forage. And one of the frustrations I've had with your department is that, and I've shared these letters with your department going back as far as the mid-1990s on the Aldrich and Todd timber sales on the Mount Deer National Forest, where the Department of Fish and Wildlife has sent comments in basically opposing vegetative management, in essence. And we're seeing it even today with a lot of the forest health and fire fuel reduction issues in Central Oregon. And when we recognize that vegetative management, if deer like early cereal stages and elk like mid-cereal stages and the Forest Service is managing for late cereal stages, it seems to me like we're setting this whole thing up for a failure. And I guess what I'd like to see is the department play a more aggressive role in trying to get the federal land management agencies to do a more aggressive role managing the vegetation on those public lands, because I think it is what they're doing is in a direct adverse impact to our big game populations.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, we certainly have been engaged with the Forest Service in a lot of different areas. There's been some fairly heated debates between us and them over some of their fire management and their controlled burning. We have no doubt that controlled burns and the goals of the plan for the fire plans to reduce danger to communities that are located in and adjacent to the forest are good. However, repeated entries and controlled burns in a very short period of time will not allow for regeneration of bitterbrush. And bitterbrush is a fairly key component to mule deer and a very important forage species for them. And what you see with repeated entries in burnings is that bitterbrush, it takes, depending on the microhabitat you're in and the subspecies of bitterbrush, it can take 5 to 10 years or even longer for a bitterbrush plant to get up to speed again and start producing seeds that mice then go and cache as a food source that if you do get another fire or catastrophic event, you then have a seed source out there that can allow for regeneration of bitterbrush. And what we've seen in some areas is that repeated entries to meet the human safety and fire goals do that, but they do have a direct impact on big game. Some of the thinning that they do, it depends on where they're doing it and the reasons they're doing it, on whether there's a value to big game or not. So it's a case-by-case and a site-by-site basis. I'm not familiar with the two that you're referring to and the letters that we've written and the circumstances around that. I know that we have, been involved in commenting on some of those and expressing some opposition that I'm aware of on some cases to what they're doing, because it's easy to go in and do an activity in an area that's a second or third or fourth entry that really doesn't address the bigger problem.
Just one sort of direct question. Do you have any clear evidence in terms of the deer population that it's been significantly impacted by the growing population of cougars?
Chair Devlin, we've been doing research with cougars for 20-plus years, and our Southwest Oregon research out of Tiller, which is between Roseburg and Grants Pass in Medford, what we found down there was that cougars did not appear to be having that big of an impact on the deer population. They appeared to be focusing from a predation standpoint primarily on elk, and that bobcats were one of the primary predators on deer fawns. What we're seeing in Northeast Oregon right now is that, again, cougars appear to be focusing on elk calves relative to deer. What we can't tell you, though, is we've come in and started these studies. They already shifted from deer over to elk. When you come in at this point in time, you don't know what's happened prior to that, and we may have missed this window out here and what may already have happened. And so those are questions that are being looked at. There's a lot of work being done across the West relative to predation. A lot of the models and a lot of the early studies from the 60s and 70s has stated that predation doesn't appear to have a lot of impact. Well, we're starting to see maybe there's some changes going on out there as some of these big game populations have declined a little bit, to where we are seeing some localized impacts of predation on some of these big game populations. We certainly have seen it on bighorn sheep in some areas. We appear to be seeing it on elk in Northeast Oregon, and some of the other states around us have seen the same thing from cougars and bears.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Sorry to interrupt, but there was another question I wanted to ask, Ron, going back to the wolf issue. I didn't quite catch what you said. There was a bill, the Dieden Committee, I believe you said, that would have, basically it was the same bill we heard, I think, in the 2005 session, dealing with the compensation plan and some of that stuff. But then you also said, there was a policy option package, some funding required. What was that for?
The policy option package, Chair Devlin and Representative Burley, was tied to the compensation associated with House Bill 2295, that if 2295 went through and set up the compensation program, then the policy option package was the general fund that would have been the monies to jumpstart that compensation program. The bill not going through, the policy option package would not.
It's approximately $200,000.
Okay, can I follow up on that, please?
Yes.
Compensation aside, the issue with the Wolf Management Plan, to me, is whether or not the federal government recognizes it as a valid conservation management plan for the gray wolf, such that they will be willing and able to either downlist or delist the gray wolf in the state of Oregon. And my question is, even if we don't get the policy option package, if we don't have the compensation portion of that plan funded, does the plan still meet the needs of the federal government to be able to downlist or delist the wolf in the state of Oregon?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, currently the federal government is looking to delist wolves as part of the distinct population segment, which includes Oregon. And there's tied into that is lots of maneuvering going on at a national scale. They have had to back off a little bit and look at the delisting located primarily with Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana. But part of that wolf population does, the line that they drew does come into Oregon. So there could be, for portions of northeast Oregon, if the federal government is successful in moving forward with delisting, wolves could be delisted for a portion of the state, primarily in northeast Oregon, but still listed for the rest of Oregon. The federal government has not accepted Oregon's management plan as a wolf recovery plan, per se. They recognize it as a good plan. They recognize it as a way to help conserve wolves in the state once they do show up, and they do recognize it as serving as the foundation for future federal delisting. And we certainly would use it as a state delisting tool when the certain targets are met within it. So I maybe confuse things a little bit, but what the federal government is proposing right now is a delisting that would take in a portion of northeast Oregon, but most of the rest of the state would still be delisted. And it's tied to the original releases that were made of wolves in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, and meeting the recovery goals that were set for that experimental population area.
Mr. Chairman, if I may very quickly, to follow up to the answer to your question, is compensation needed to get through all of the loops for recovery? Not likely. The management plans will operate independent of that, whether that compensation package is there, as the Fish and Wildlife Service begins to look those plans over and decide whether or not they would constitute recovery plans. The compensation for the loss of livestock is not a factor that they've been taking into consideration.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
I must have missed something in 2005 because I don't remember the discussion that the Oregon Gray Wolf Conservation Plan needed to meet the same standards as a federal ESA recovery plan for that species. My understanding was, and let me give you an example, the state of Wyoming still to this day has not been delisted or downlisted. Why? Because the state has not adopted a conservation plan for the gray wolf. Oregon has, despite the fact that we don't have the compensation package. The commission adopted it. So, you know, something's changed between 2005 and now based on what you're telling me, because for one, the conservation plan was never meant to be a federal recovery plan, and two, how can the feds possibly consider downlisting or delisting in only a portion of the state when it's the same management plan that's consistent throughout the state?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, it's complicated at a national level, and the service originally was proposing a delisting for the whole western distinct population segment. based on legal challenges, they backed off and focused on the area that included the three states in the experimental population. As part of that delisting, what they do is they look at where wolves are located within those states, and then what's the expected range of those animals out from that. So they draw a circle or a line based on home range sizes, etc., that extends from Idaho into a portion of Oregon, into a portion of Washington. And as a delisting process, we would say if we would expect that because of the location of a wolf pack here in Idaho, that they could be ranging here into Oregon, and that delisting needs to also occur in this portion of Oregon. It does not line up with what we have in our plan as far as the east-west boundaries within our plan. We've submitted comments to the federal government on that, requesting that they line themselves up with our plan. But you're right, they don't have to accept our plan as a delisting plan. And they're really drawn back and focused on that three-state area from a delisting standpoint, and will approach each of the other states probably on a case-by-case basis after that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to take up any more of this subcommittee's time, but I would certainly like to follow up with you. And I feel a little bit, frankly, betrayed. Not necessarily by your department so much as by the federal government, because we had a representative of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service come down here in 2005, testify before the Ag and Natural Resources Committee. The Senate Minority Leader and I both met with him personally, and what you're telling me is completely different from what we were told in 2005. Completely. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Moving on to the next sub-program, that would be the Habitat Program. It begins with tab, the Habitat tab on page 135. Limitation request for the Habitat Program is just a little bit over $30 million.
Mr. Chair,
yes. I'm sorry, I didn't realize we're just leaving the Wildlife Division game and going into Habitat. Can I ask a question about
and we may want to touch upon some of the policy option packages also. And
Chair Devlin, I was planning on doing that when we got back into each of those specifically. I was just focusing on the key issues in each of them right now.
Representative Clem, is it about a policy option package or one of the key issues?
I don't know. It's about the impact of Senate Bill 859, which is a checkoff bill on the Wildlife Division in general.
Oh, okay.
Chair Devlin, that's within the diversity program. If you'd like to wait, I can touch on that for you during when we get to the diversity portion of the program. The Habitat program, again, is made up of a combination of other funds, federal fund, general fund, and lottery funds. And there's several big federal fund programs within the Habitat section. The two major ones are the Landowner Improvement Program and then the BPA Habitat Restoration Mitigation Program. And Landowner Improvement is designed by the federal government for state agencies to provide federal money to private landowners to address species at risk. Oregon has been one of the most successful states in the country in securing funds through this program, getting it out on the ground and getting those funds obligated. We have had some problems dealing with some of the federal compliance issues and getting approval for those projects to move forward through the feds, but we are held up as a model for the rest of the nation on being successful in securing those funds and getting those funds out on the ground and projects approved to be out on the ground for restoration work. The BPA program, both of these are tied into some policy option packages, but the BPA program is the same type of thing. It's associated with actions taken to by Bonneville Power that impact the Willamette Basin and doing mitigation work within the Willamette Basin. One of the key programs within Habitat that I'd like to touch on a little bit because of budget impacts both from a POP and also from the 2009 session, is the Access and Habitat program. This is a program that's funded by a $2 surcharge on hunter licenses and by the auction and raffle of deer and elk tags. These funds are dedicated to securing access onto private land for hunters and to conduct habitat work on private land for big game. And during the course of this biennium, the program has secured 3.5 million acres of private land and opened that to public access and done a little over a million acres of habitat improvement work for big game. Also during this biennium, and one of the key components of it, is that when we have large wildfires, a lot of times those occur on private lands, and through the A&H program, we have set up a special fund where we can very quickly get funds to those private landowners to purchase seed and fertilizer to apply on the burned areas to reduce erosion impacts and to provide forage for big game. It's been a very popular program. This is the second or third biennium that we've run it, and landowners are very appreciative of that because we can very quickly get them funds through an abbreviated grant process for them to do work on the ground to mitigate the impacts of those fires. The reason that it's so important to talk about it is that the A&H program sunsets in December of 2009. So by the next session, as an agency, we'll be needing to pull together a work group of our Access and Habitat Board and other constituents to look at the program, do a complete review of it, and make recommendations to us as an agency on whether we want to continue the program beyond 2009. Based on comments that we've heard, it appears to be very popular with hunters and does get a lot of use, but we want to talk to them about that and make sure that it is fulfilling hunters' needs and wants, and if there are tweaks that need to be made to the program, that we can bring that forward in a legislative concept for the next session. One of the key issues within the habitat program are land use changes. This is occurring as a result of a couple of different things. One, obviously, is Measure 37. We're starting to see some claims come through where people are asking on what are the impacts to fish and wildlife as a result of Measure 37. But even bigger than that is just as we see a continued population growth within the state, we're seeing more and more pressure to develop wildlands where typically big game and other sensitive and critical wildlife species live. And we're seeing impacts as a result of that. And there's a lot of demand on the department's time to provide technical assistance. County planning departments depend quite heavily on our staff to provide them comments on proposed development plans and where possible mitigation of those plans. And wrapped into all of that are the Goal 5 sensitive resource sites that the counties have adopted, and we work with the counties on to minimize impacts on those sensitive sites. The last major program within the Wildlife Division is also the smallest. It's the Diversity Sub-Program, and it's the tab for it's found on page 138. It consists primarily of federal fund and general fund and then a little bit of other fund, which are the checkoff dollars that were mentioned by Representative Clem and donations. The Wildlife Diversity Program is charged with managing 88% of the fish and wildlife species in this state that are not hunted or fished. And we cannot use, as an agency, license dollars for running the diversity program. It's a direction we've had up to this point in time. And so we depend pretty heavily on the federal funds that we get and then whatever funds we can get off the checkoff and off out of general fund to run the program. The program has expanded here recently a little bit as a result of the state conservation strategy, which is the key issue within this program. We have received federal dollars through what's called the State Wildlife Grant Program. It's the same funding that we use for the Wolf Program. And out of that, we have developed a conservation strategy for Oregon that addresses the species and habitats that are of greatest risk. It's been a high priority of the current federal administration that states become actively involved along with the federal government in trying to prevent species from being listed. And that was the major impetus of the State Wildlife Grants Program and the conservation strategies. Consequently, what all the states have done, and Oregon along with that, is developed a strategy that builds on the voluntary actions of landowners to take steps to improve habitats and to preserve where appropriate habitats so that species will not continue to decline, some of the sensitive species, and lead to further listings and all the impacts associated with those listings. We've completed the planning process, and we're starting to move into the implementation process. And as a key issue and from a budget standpoint, at least at this point in time, we still have assurance that we can move forward with the current 25-75 match with the federal dollars. But starting in 09, we also will end up needing to provide a 50-50 match to any of the federal dollars that we spend ourselves through the program. What the diversity program as a whole suffers from is a lack of a long-term, stable, and substantial amount of funding that allows us to address a lot of these species. And as an agency, that is something that we've been concerned about for a long time. The question was asked by Representative Klim about the checkoff program, and that the non-game fund or the non-game tax checkoff was actually the first one that was established in the state back in 1978. And it was designed by the legislature and conservation groups to provide funding for non-game wildlife. It was the first dedicated funding for non-game wildlife in the state. And we've been a recipient of those funds ever since that point in time. And as there's been other programs added to the tax checkoff, we've seen a little bit of a decline in the revenue associated with that. But we do have a program built on the tax checkoff, and we do have some positions associated with that. Two of our three wildlife diversity field staff are associated with the checkoff funds, and we do have half of our sole marine mammal biologist associated with those funds.
This really is not a budget question, Mr. Chair, but it's a question that I've had on my mind for quite some time, Ron. Someone has a piece of land which has a deer overlay for protection. They file a 37 claim. At what point are you forced to withdraw that overlay? When the claim is awarded?
Chair Devlin, Representative Girard, I don't know that we as an agency are forced to withdraw the overlay. The overlays are typically adopted by the counties within the county plan and within the Goal 5 resources within the plan. And what it falls down to is a decision to be made by the county on whether they want to continue within the Goal 5 resources to recognize that sensitive habitat overlay and keep it within or part of the county plan or not. And we wouldn't necessarily withdraw it because the species have told us where those sensitive habitats are, and it becomes a county decision at that point in time on what they would like to do.
So you would follow whatever, basically you would acknowledge whatever the county, the local government decided? Or
Chair Devlin, Representative Girard, that's correct. The county plans drive what goes on out on the ground. All we can do is make the recommendations to the county on what the biology and the species are telling us, and then it becomes the county's decision on what they want to do.
I'm still, I was actually trying to find Senate Bill 859, but this is a bill that comes out of the Senate. And it's got, it looks to me like changes to the program. It's sponsored at the request of the Oregon Head Start Association, but I can't tell if it's just cleaning up and saying that it limits the number of things it can be on. But
Representative Klem, what it basically does is that I can't remember the existing number we have on the form. It's something like 7 or 8. It asks them to increase the number to 12, if possible, on the form. Currently and under this,
you can both designate an entity that's qualified on the form, and you can also designate one of the entities that's listed actually in your tax guide on one of the open lines. What it would do in this case, basically, is because the wildlife checkoff had been on there probably the longest, is once the bill became effective, which I think is probably the issue that's probably under debate, is they would go off from being listed on the form to being one that you could actually write in. Now, historically, those that you have written in have done considerably poorer than those that are on the form, with a couple of notable exceptions. Still not as well as being on the form, but those entities that are clearly recognizable by interests, sometimes even if they're not even on the form, are actually identified when people file their forms. The question is how much impact this would have on ODFW and on this program, and I think there are different expectations. I think the most common one that I've heard is that they would probably lose probably in the neighborhood, and that's only speculation, probably in the neighborhood of half the funds, unless there was some overarching effort in terms of other communications to parties, maybe to licensees, that might actually lead to more people actually choosing to write them in, actually writing in the code for them. But the other side of this issue is that there's some belief that there are a lot of interests out there that would benefit from being on the form, and it's not probably fair to pick only five or six and let them be permanently on the form.
Does it rotate people off and on?
Yeah. So you'll be having to make a decision on it in the next 30 days, in the next 16 days.
I just wanted to, before we get all the way out of the wildlife area, request again something maybe in writing that describes the process for which in-state residents gain advantage, if there is one. I think there is some sort of 5% threshold or criteria, but I'd like to have that so I can understand it a little better. That's one of my other solutions to my instincts about why people aren't hunting have involved a lot of things that other people have said, not being able to get tags, but I've seen some of the statistics that say that it's still far more in-state hunters than out-of-state hunters, but when you're down to so few tags, it actually irritates you a lot when you're watching the rigs from California pull into your campsite right as you're trying to get in there. And so I'd like to know how this is set up so I can think a little bit more about that.
Chair Devlin, Representative Klim, we certainly can do a follow-up for you. Just as an example, in 1996, we had a little over 15,000 non-residents hunted in Oregon. And in 2006, that number had grown to 23,000. During the same time, resident hunters in 1996, we had 302,000, and in 2006, we had 256,000. So what it works out to is the non-resident rate in 2006 was about 8.2% of the hunters, and in 1996, it was about 4.8% of the hunters. So we have seen an increase. A lot of our controlled hunts, we do reach the 5% cap that the legislature's put in place, but we still see a lot of participation in the general seasons, archery season, and Western Oregon seasons.
5% cap, meaning the non-residents can only constitute 5% of the total hunts or controlled tags issued?
That's correct, Chair Devlin, Representative Klim. The legislature passed a law several years ago that limited the total number of non-residents in deer and elk seasons to 5%.
Is there any...
Yes.
Is there, seems like this is where I was now. I'm starting to remember all this now. Was there speculation that we're not even allowed to do that if somebody wanted to challenge that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Klim, a couple of years ago, there was a challenge in New Mexico under the Interstate Commerce Act where New Mexico Game and Fish was limiting non-resident opportunity, and it went to court, and New Mexico lost in court, and pretty much opened up the door to non-resident hunting, and the state not being able to put any limitation on non-resident participation in any of the hunts. Since that time, the states and some of the major players from a national perspective talked with Congress and were able to get some legislation passed that recognized the state's ability to regulate non-residents. However, there were caveats associated with that, that Congress did not want to see the states taking overly restrictive actions to restrict non-resident participation. But they were watching it closely, and they wanted to make sure that states were not retaliating over the lawsuit that had happened and the losses that had occurred at that point in time. So we are being collectively watched by Department of Congress or Commerce and by the federal Congress over the Interstate Commerce Act and what actions the states are taking with non-residents and limitations on non-residents. But we will follow up with some more information for you, Representative.
At this particular point, since I don't know exactly when we will finish up here, there are a couple of housekeeping items. One is that I wanted to announce for anyone that might be communicating to people that might testify tomorrow that it has never been this chair's intent to close hatcheries, that even though the co-chair's budget could have potentially closed hatcheries, the chair has had discussion with the co-chairs. It is no longer their intent to close hatcheries. And so if anyone is concerned about that issue, the only thing that could potentially change any of the issues that I just spoken about is if we were to have a particularly negative revenue forecast tomorrow, which no one is anticipating. But for any of those that might have the ability to communicate to people that might want to testify tomorrow, we have no intent of cutting items in the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to an extent where they could justify the closing of hatcheries. And given that, where are we in terms of, we've got about 20 minutes left. Would it be best that we go through the remaining portions of wildlife and then leave admin and capital till tomorrow, hopefully at the close of testimony, or it might have to be Wednesday morning, because I don't know if we could actually get through everything today in the remaining 20 minutes. So,
Chair Devlin, I probably have another 10 minutes to go through the POPs, and then Representative Dingfelder, who's not here right at the moment, had asked a question on wildlife viewing that I've got a pretty comprehensive reply for her on.
Okay.
So if you'd like, if we could skip over to the POPs and go through those real quick.
That would be
and
fine.
And then leave the other question for the representative when she gets back.
Okay.
Moving forward to the POPs, the first one is in game management, which would be on page 124 of your book. That's the wolf or policy option package that at this point in time probably would not be moving forward because it's tied to the legislation. The next POP is on page 126. This is package 180. This has to do with wildlife dedicated and obligated expenditure authority. And specifically, this is tied to the specific accounts that we have set up through the legislature for some of these specialized programs. And what we're asking for in antelope is ongoing expenditure authority of $40,000 for conducting work. And then the others are all one-time increases over existing limitation that would allow us to do expanded work under those programs. Moving forward to wildlife habitat, and on page 130, the first thing we'd like to talk about is essential package 50. These are the fund shifts. This is the Western Oregon Stream Restoration Program that in the past has been on a combination of lottery fund and PCSRF funds, and as part of the reversion would be shifting back off of some of those funds and over to general funds, and in combination with lottery funds.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just make a point on this package. You'll see a lottery fund for Measure 66 fund shift, and as part of the agreement with DAS and the construction of the 07-09 budget, we agreed that any PCSRF monies would be shifted back to general fund, but not Measure 66. So you're likely to see in the co-chair budget, you did see, and in LFO recommendations, you'll see that these will expenditures will stay on lottery funds as we go forward with the LFO recommendations in the future. I just wanted to point that out for you.
Yes.
I'll just on the PCSRF, are those going away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, that's correct. There's a revenue problem with the Pacific Coastal SAM recovery funds. We're not anticipating the same level of money as we did. We certainly don't have that problem with lottery funds in this state.
Chair Devlin, the next package is package 171. This is a two-piece package. It contains limitation and position authority for an ODOT liaison position and also expenditure authority for Willamette Valley BPA mitigation program. The BPA program is tied to ongoing efforts for conservation easements, habitat restoration, protection work within the Willamette Valley. The ODOT liaison position is tied to work that would be expanding down in southwestern Oregon. We have been working closely with ODOT over the last few years as part of the bridge replacement program, the Transportation Investment Act, and have a very extensive program within the state where we provide them with technical assistance, working through permits, and helping them to speed up their process and saving the contractors funds and getting their projects on the ground sooner and quicker. And I don't know, Paul, if you wanted to address some of the things associated with that at this point in time or not.
With the BPA?
With ODOT.
With ODOT. I believe in the co-chair budget, the co-chairs had some concerns about adding another position on ODOT funding, and so we'll be looking at that as we move into work session.
The next package is on page 133. This is policy package 180, and again, this is one-time or ongoing limitation for the Oncala oil spill mitigation project, and then one-time increases for A&H and the Pacific Gas Transmission mitigation. The Oncala oil spill was a result of a train wreck just north of Rice Hill several years ago, and this was the funds that were set up as a result of that to mitigate for impacts to fish and wildlife programs. And what we discovered as we went through our agency budget back in the early 2000s was somehow in the process these funds, they were still in the agency, but the limitation was not set aside for expenditure and doing on-the-ground work, and we're asking for some ongoing implementation now to start doing that mitigation work at the local level. The funds would be spent in cooperation with Douglas County Salmon Habitat Improvement Program and would be for specific fish-related and upland mitigation projects associated with that area. A&H limitation would, again, be for continuation of securing access onto private land and to do additional big game habitat projects. And likewise, the Pacific Gas Transmission mitigation was as a result of a fairly large project back in the 90s where a gas line was put in through eastern Oregon. There were impacts to wildlife as a result of that. Mitigation account was set up, and again, it was one of those where we never got the spending authority and the limitation to go in and expend those funds to do the mitigation work, and we're requesting that at this point in time. There are no costs within the Wildlife Diversity Program, so that outside of answering Representative Gingfelder's question on wildlife viewing, that would conclude my presentation.
Okay. Why don't we go to Representative Gingfelder's question first, and then we'll see if there are any other questions from the committee.
Okay, thank you, Chair Devlin. Representative, the other day you asked about wildlife viewing and what all we were doing to track that. relative to our wildlife areas and as a state. And we actually have done quite a bit of work on that over the years. We can't give a statewide perspective, but we can focus in very easily on our wildlife areas that we manage. We currently have 12 staff wildlife areas that are funded through license dollars and federal PR dollars, which are the federal excise tax on the sale of arms and ammunition. And on those 12 areas, we receive an estimated 2 million public user days annually. And of those 2 million days, we estimate that only 600,000 of those days are actually by hunters, trappers, and anglers. The other 1.4 million are by non-consumptive users. And outside of our Savi Island wildlife area, outside of Portland, none of the areas receive any funds from the public for operation. Savi Island does have a parking permit that's required for anybody to come onto the area, and that generates somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 a year that is used to provide services for the uses made by the non-consumptive public. And that includes increased law enforcement. We have a special deputy that works Savi Island that's paid out of the parking permit fees, providing portable toilets. We have inmate crews that come in and do litter cleanup, and we have a part-time office coordinator that helps implement the permit system and some of the workload associated with the increased use on the wildlife area. So all the rest of the areas we see a significant, or all of the areas outside of Savi are funded entirely from license dollars and PR dollars. We are seeing an increase in demand and use for our wildlife areas every year. And with that has come demands that we stop hunting on the wildlife areas, we stop fishing, and that we make them into biking areas, hiking areas, viewing areas solely, and people really struggling with not understanding how those areas are funded, and that actually for a good portion of these areas and a good portion of the time, the non-consumptive users get more use on these areas than what the hunters and the fishermen and the anglers do. And it was also interesting in the 2001 federal survey that for Oregon, and this was some of the information that the director referenced the other day, that there were 1.2 million people surveyed for Oregon that participated in wildlife viewing. And of those 1.2 million people, 611,000 of them were actually residents of the state. A lot of the others were considered non-residents. And of those 611,000 residents, 352,000 of them, so the 611 that actively participated in wildlife viewing, 352,000 of those people also hunted and fished. So a significant portion of our hunters and fishermen also participate in wildlife viewing activities. So we are seeing a significant increase in wildlife viewing and demands for non-consumptive activities. We're seeing tours being established to come into our wildlife areas, elder hostels, school groups wanting to have viewing opportunities and explanations on how the ecosystem works, how the environment works, and their role in all of that, and an increasing workload on our staff. And there is certainly a demand out there, and at this point in time, we're struggling to meet that demand, quite frankly. Our staff are stretched to the limit with meeting their normal program duties and roles and responsibilities, much less with the end. So Representative Dingfelder, I hope I was able to answer your question for you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Partially, I guess the question that I have is, and I know that the commission is looking at alternatives in the future, so I certainly hope that during the interim that the director will be at least coming in front of my policy committee and providing updates on how the commission is addressing that. The way I see it is that these different uses are not mutually exclusive but complementary, and I think we need to figure out a way to capitalize, especially seeing that, you know, hunting is a short time of the year where wildlife viewing is year-round, and certainly I know I just stay out of the woods during that time of the year. I certainly don't want to get in the way of any hunters, so I don't think it's necessarily a lot to ask people, but I think we need to figure out how given the increase in demands for facilities. And I will say I use the Saugus Island facilities, and they're great facilities. I really appreciate the work that you guys do out there, that we can capitalize on that type of service that we can provide and make sure that there, I really think there's a willingness to pay for it. And I realize we have a challenge in the states. It's been on our sales tax. Many other states fund this through a surcharge on equipment through the sales tax. I know Washington has a dedicated fund, and that's one thing we're always struggling with here. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I'm kind of a good subject. One of the things I'm seeing now in my part of the country, and we're getting a few phone calls, is the farmers are now starting to go to no tillage, less traditional type of farming, and they're actually using sheep as weed control factor. And so I'm starting to get calls from people talking about predation on sheep and wildlife control, and we were talking about counties and the counties control, and there's federal agencies involved. It's kind of a small part of the budget right now, but isn't there so is the budget include some of this, some of that combination of federal, county, state monies to for wildlife control?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, yes, in the game program budget. There is a small portion of our budget that is set aside for predator control. And by statute, in Division 609, or in ORS 609, the department is required to contribute to the county predator control fund. And the legislature appropriates $120,000 a biennium to us that then we contract with Wildlife Services to conduct predator control work around the state in the participating counties. So we do have a portion of our budget set aside for predator control work to meet our statutory obligations.
Sounds like $120,000 probably doesn't go very far, though, does it, or does it? In the entire state.
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, it's not a very large pot of money. There's also money, I believe, in Department of Agriculture's budget, and then that's matched. Both of those are matched up with funds that come out of participating counties. And certainly Representative Girard probably remembers that from his work down in Klamath as county commissioner, and then also from the federal government and Wildlife Services budget itself.
Mr. Chair, this seems like this is, I can see a trend starting out in our part of the country, just that this is going to become a bigger and bigger thing, because, I mean, the folks are using less fuel, they're not tilling the ground. You know, and they get the sheep out there, get a little fertilizer. And I mean, it's kind of one of those win-win situations where I see that it's going to be very innovative. But just to add on to all that is that when you're talking about wildlife, maybe you should add farmers into your thing, too, because I sit out there in my little tractor. Mm-hmm. Last couple of weeks ago, there was 1,200 deer going, popping across the bay. I see pheasants and coyotes and all sorts of things. Makes me feel good, Chair.
You didn't say anything about when it's during season, if you see them out there.
Oh, wow. I never heard.
One last question, since I know we're running out of time, and this is, I think, the last day that you're here for testimony.
It might not be.
I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about the conservation strategy yet, because I was missed part of the presentation, which I apologize. But yeah, I'd be curious to see how that is integrated into your budget, if there are any specific COPs, or maybe I don't think I saw one specific to implementing this, or if you have any plans for the future, I think that would be helpful. I was really impressed with this document, and I realize this is a voluntary program, but I certainly think that it's a really good partnership with the department.
Mr. Moore, if you'd like to comment briefly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, Ron did go over the budget. We do not have any POPs in that particular program. Most of the work on the strategy is now focused on implementing with the funds we have, which is a fairly modest pot at this point, but we're making some gains. The work that we've started with the conservation community is looking at, just as you discussed, are there any other diversity of funding out there, any other sources of funding that the public in this state would be willing to support. And we're actively working on that. That's going to be part of our discussions with the public starting this winter with the External Budget Advisory Committee. We'll be looking at trying to fully fund that package in some way, shape, or form. We're estimating right now what we think it would take to accomplish much of what's in there, and staff is working on that right now. We're building the foundation that says, here's what you would get for X amount of money relative to implementing that strategy. Most of that should become visible starting late this fall as we pull that information together.
At this particular point, committee, I think we will be closing this hearing. Just some announcements. Tomorrow we will have public testimony. And I know that the House is going into session at 8:30. If at all possible, I would request that House members...
Oh, we're in hearing room F.
We're in hearing room F tomorrow. Okay. Another announcement.
Mr. Chair, question. Yes. Along those lines, on the schedule we were given today,
yes,
on the reverse side, it says no meeting scheduled for Tuesday, May 15th. Or Wednesday, May 16th.
Correct. I believe those dates are incorrect. If you look at the Monday the 21st, that would be Tuesday the 22nd, Wednesday the 23rd, and then the
24th.
That's the problem, I think, when it starts counting automatically.
Small.
Okay. Plus, we're just trying to check to see if people were reading.
So tomorrow, we're in hearing room F.
Hearing room F. I realize that the House is going to the floor at 8:30. I do not know what level of controversy the bills are that are on the floor. But if at all possible, if you can get excused for part of that time, because this will be the time when the public is coming in to testify on these items. We do anticipate that there will be quite a few members of the public, and the chair will be challenged to get them all in the hour and a half that we have. And then we will have to come back, I believe, for a little bit on Wednesday to finish up on the agency's presentation. And on Wednesday, we'll also be attempting to bring back the state parks budget for some additional modifications. And on Thursday, I believe we are on schedule to consider the DEQ budget. And then if we can get through all of that, the following week, you might get a couple of days off, although I am trying to get some policy bills from the co-chairs that some of you have requested. And I do not know when the co-chairs will make those decisions, but we're trying to get them. So, but with that, I will close this public hearing. And hopefully, I know you may not be able to be here for the entire hearing tomorrow, but it would look good if we had a few House members.
I'd love to be there. I wouldn't want to miss that for anything.
I represent Burley. I've already announced that we do not have any intent to close hatcheries. So.
I heard that, but I'm also interested in that.